This has been the hottest summer on record in many East Coast cities and many other parts of the country. That heat has brought with it a lot of days with unhealthy air. At least 75 areas from Portland, Maine to San Francisco are warning residents to expect high air pollution today. Here's NPR's Elizabeth Shogren with our report.
All the bad air days mean that at daycare centers like Little Flowers in Washington, D.C., children are spending a lot of time cooped up inside.
And now we're taking them outside for 15 minutes so they can play with the sprinkler.
Ileana Noguchi says the children normally would go to the playground several times a day for 40 minutes each time. But with code red air quality, they get one short recess.
Ready? Go! Who's going to be the brave one? Come on, let's go!
As tiny feet slap the pavement in a happy sprinkler dance, Noguchi says some toddlers are missing. They have asthma, and their parents pick them up early to avoid even this brief time outside. Norman Edelman, the chief medical officer for the American Lung Association, says children are especially vulnerable to bad air days, particularly if they have asthma.
Kids are always running around, so they breathe a lot more for their size than adults do. So they take in more of this bad stuff.
That means that even healthy children should limit their time outside on code orange days when the air is unhealthy for sensitive groups, and on code red days when the air is bad for everyone. Ozone and fine particles are the two types of pollution that trigger code red and orange days. Both are formed out of the exhaust from power plants, cars, and a lot of other things. Edelman says with ozone,
the two bad chemical actors are oxides of nitrogen and hydrocarbons. When they're exposed to heat and sunlight, a chemical reaction takes place which releases ozone.
And when people breathe it in, it irritates their lungs.
So if you look down the airway of somebody exposed to excessive ozone, it would look like a bad sunburn of the airways.
And since children's airways are a lot smaller than adults, it doesn't take much swelling to cause an asthma attack. High levels of fine particles also trigger bad air days in summertime, especially in the east. Coal-fired power plants are the main culprit, and on the hottest days, they're working at full tilt to keep air conditioners running. The elderly and people with lung and heart problems are at high risk, but Edelman says even if you're healthy, you shouldn't ignore bad air days. It's probably best to do outdoor exercise in the morning before the sun and exhaust have turned the air into an unhealthy soup. Not at, say, 5 p.m. when two teams of federal workers are slugging it out on a steamy softball field.
Come on, Dwight. Come on.
So I know two other teams played it safe today and called the next two games off. So, and it's not that bad out here.
Army Corps of Engineers shortstop Matt Unger says his players are used to the heat after serving in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Oh, good. That's
turns out their opponents, self-described bureaucrats from the Government Accountability Office, are pretty tough, too. Still panting from her run around the bases, Kim Giannopoulos admits that, like a lot of other people, she doesn't pay much attention to air pollution alerts.
You don't get too much opportunity these days to get out and have fun with your coworkers and do this kind of thing, so got to take advantage of it, you know.
Dr. Edelman says if you do exert yourself on bad air days, don't ignore symptoms like burning lungs or irritated eyes. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. When Captain John Smith entered the Chesapeake Bay in the summer of 1608, he found oysters in abundance. He wrote in his journal, "They lay as thick as stones." By the 1800s, watermen were harvesting millions of bushels of oysters every year. Chesapeake oysters became a delicacy served in the country's finest restaurants. But the succulent shellfish have been loved almost to extinction. Overfishing, disease, and pollution have left the Chesapeake with only about 1% of the oysters it had back then. Now scientists and business people are making some headway in bringing them back for the sake of oyster lovers and the bay. We hear that story from NPR's Elizabeth Shogren.
Marine biologist David Schulte has been trying to engineer a recovery for the bay's oysters, starting with one of its small tributaries. We set anchor over one of the reefs he built on Virginia's Great Wicomico River, and he sends what looks like a lime green canister vacuum cleaner overboard. It's a remote-controlled submarine. Schulte's theory was, if you build it, and build it big enough, they will come. And for the past several years, baby oysters have been coming by the millions to his reefs.
Now that's a great shot right there.
He's peering at a screen at lots of craggy shells standing on end in the murky brown water.
Those oysters are all growing very vertically, very densely packed together. Really, this was the first time this was documented in the Chesapeake Bay in over a century.
1,000 oysters per square meter. That's what nature used to provide, but no one had been able to mimic it. Schulte says his restoration project is working where many others failed because he came up with a radically new recipe. After studying successful restoration projects in other parts of the world, he decided he had to build reefs much larger than earlier efforts. Instead of 1 acre, his was 100 acres. And after reading historic accounts of what oyster reefs once looked like, he decided his reefs had to be higher. So he piled up enough shell to stick up a foot or more from the river bottom instead of a few inches. He hoped that would prevent the oysters from being smothered by the muck, like in previous experiments.
And it turns out that from all the data that we've got, I was right.
Why would that be controversial?
It hadn't been done, and it's more expensive.
Schulte works for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and he got $3 million for his project. He says his experiments should be scaled up across the bay to restore the Chesapeake oyster. But lots of other scientists are skeptical. Professor Roger Mann of the Virginia Institute of Marine Science says it would be wildly expensive.
Once you get into trying to do restoration in very large rivers, the quantities of shell that are needed and the dollars that are involved in it get to be extraordinary. And before you start spending those amounts, you need to be absolutely sure that your recipe that you're using is right.
Mann is showing me a hatchery at his university where he and other scientists are breeding oysters. In one room, several huge vats are filled with vividly colored water, one lemon yellow, one pea green, and others different shades of brown.
What you see here is increasing concentrations of algae. This is the food factory for the oysters.
Oysters eat lots of algae. That's what makes them so valuable to the bay. Scientists estimate that there used to be so many oysters in the Chesapeake that they could filter the whole bay in several days. Now it takes the few oysters that are left about a year to do the same job. Mann believes the best way to bring back oysters is to promote a new industry on the Chesapeake, oyster farming. That way, businesses, not taxpayers, will be footing the bill to put millions of the filter feeders back in the bay.
There's a lot of very clever people who are in this industry who are willing to work hard to build their oyster farms, and in doing so, I think, can have really positive ecological effects.
People like Ryan Croxton. Croxton is counting oysters he just pulled from cages in Virginia's Rappahannock River. Croxton started oyster farming with his cousin several years ago. His grandfather used to supply oysters to Campbell Soup. But no one had harvested for many years, and the family was about to lose leases it had to work the river.
We wanted to keep the lease alive. It had been in our family since the 1890s. And that's when we realized that there was kind of a disconnect in the way we were doing it and the way we ought to be doing it.
His grandfather's teams dragged big dredges across the bottom of the river, ripping up the habitat as they went. The Croxtons now grow oysters in cages. They started the farm so they could have a private stash, but they loved the product so much that they decided to aim big.
So we got a Zagat guide, and we looked at the number one restaurant in New York City, which was La Bernardin, and just called the reservation line. I mean, it's easy to be bold when you got nothing to lose. And we're able to get an audience with the chef and showed him the oyster. He absolutely loved it.
Now they sell 30,000 to 40,000 oysters a week for the half-shell market.
And what about the practices that your grandfather used? What do you think about them now?
that's my blood, so I got to be careful. But I do feel bad about the techniques that they used. We've completely abandoned all of them.
Croxton says instead of tearing down the bay like his predecessors, his operation is helping revive it. He takes me out to see his farm, a line of cages in the Rappahannock's choppy water. Croxton says there's no question that the hundreds of thousands of oysters below us are helping remove pollution.
I mean, each one of these oysters is filtering like 50 to 60 gallons of water a day.
So I'll hop in and pull up a clump of these oysters.
Tommy Leggett agrees that operations like Croxton's do some good. Leggett's an oyster farmer, too. But he also heads up oyster restoration in Virginia for the environmental group Chesapeake Bay Foundation. And he's become a believer in big-scale restoration projects. Thanks to a mini version he built on a tiny creek.
So here's one shell in my hand with three nice oysters on it. And this is all wild oysters from the creek.
Leggett says he hoped some wild baby oysters would settle on the mound of shells he dumped into the creek, but he's been thrilled by how many mature oysters have made this their home. He says large restoration projects would be less likely to fail because of threats like sediment and predators, and would be well worth the high price tag.
We're not going to restore the Chesapeake Bay without oysters, period. It's one of the most important cleaners of the bay that we have.
And Leggett says now is a good time to make big public investments in rescuing oysters. His group recently came out with a report documenting that fewer oysters are dying from two diseases that have long plagued them and suggesting that they may be developing some resistance. This is good news for oyster farmers and the bay. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. You can connect with NPR and your favorite member station, wherever you are. Get the NPR app for your mobile device. You can also lean back and enjoy NPR.org, optimized for the iPad. This is NPR.
The roaring Indus River runs the length of Pakistan, beginning in the Tibetan Plateau and dumping out into the Arabian Sea. Pakistan's ruinous floods have reached the nearby city of Hyderabad, and the delta city of Tata has been emptied of its 150,000 inhabitants by orders of the government. The UN says since Wednesday, another 1 million people have been displaced in the southern province of Sindh. And NPR's Julie McCarthy is there and has this report.
We're looking at the Khotri Barrage, a water barrier that diverts part of the Indus River. And as this river has traveled the length of the country, it has created floods, its embankments have busted, it has destroyed millions of acres of crops and inundated villages that never saw the Indus River before. Yet, all those miles and all that water diverted, the river here at Khotri, in the southern part of Sindh, is running at what authorities call exceptionally high flood waters. You can hear the roar of the water as it passes through this barrage. The UN says that emergency shelters are helping only 4% of the displaced population in Sindh. Dazed and drawn people inhabit roadsides and stampede relief trucks. Writer Mohammed Hanif is author of the bestseller, A Case of Exploding Mangoes, about the mysterious death of Pakistani dictator General Zia-ul-Haq. Witnessing the disaster, Hanif says it's as if scenes are being reenacted from partition, the tumultuous division of the subcontinent into Pakistan and India that displaced millions a half a century ago.
And what you see in those images is this mass of humanity on their donkey carts, old men kind of carrying all their household stuff, sort of old women who've been separated from their families. You see lots and lots of children loaded up on carts. But it's quite obvious from those images that they don't really know where they're going.
With people lost and desperate, there's rancor in the air. A man flanked by his clan argues with a woman from a local aid group. He says his people are being warehoused with no proper food or medicine. A blistered baby, burned after plunging into a vat of oil in search of food, is presented as Exhibit A of how little the government has done to provide the basics. Writer Mohammed Hanif says ignorance about the victims, some of the poorest rural people in Pakistan, compounds the cruelty.
These people kind of live lives which are almost invisible to us. So there's a certain mindset which thinks that these people have just moved to the cities and they've suddenly become greedy. They want food, they want medicine, they want shelter, they want toilets, they want washrooms for their women. And it's horrible to say, but there are people who say, but did they have all of this before? Well, the truth is that they did.
Near the raging river last night, a small group of Hindus converged. Conch shells blaring, they came to pray for deliverance. The river is sacred and we seek its blessing, they said. But for now, the River Indus is deadly and outrunning any efforts to tame it. Thousands of survivors near the inundated town of Tata are huddled around the mausoleums in the graveyard of Necropolis, a World Heritage Site where they sought higher ground. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Hyderabad, Pakistan.
Listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. In New York's Adirondack Mountains, the state has been reopening traditional canoe routes that had been closed for generations. Paddlers are free once again to explore some of the most remote wilderness in the Northeast. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann made the journey to Lake Lila and sent this audio postcard.
Early on the second morning of our trip, I paddled with my brother Alan up a winding creek that flows out of Rock Pond.
It's a beautiful wetland on either side of the stream. Every couple hundred yards, there's a beaver lodge. The sound of birds on both sides of the stream. It's like a wildlife sanctuary here.
It's nice to be out early.
Yeah, the sun's just rising at our backs.
There are millions of people just a few hours' drive from this chain of mountain ponds and streams. But today it's just the two of us and our canoes. We pull up on shore and hoist our boats on our backs, wading off through a swamp of waist-deep mud.
Try to kind of go around the margins of this pool right here. It's deep.
There was a time when people used routes like this, sort of like backcountry highways. To reach the most remote valleys of the Adirondacks, you still have to lug everything over land, hopping from pond to pond, creek to creek. On this day, the heat comes up fierce, and cicadas whine in the trees. We reach the next pond, and to celebrate, we throw ourselves into the black water, washing away the mud and sweat. Alan and I grew up in Alaska's North Woods. We're in our 40s now, but this feels like one of those summer trips when we were kids, when it seemed like we were the only people on the planet.
It's the last morning of our trip, and it's early. I'm not sure exactly what time, but I've been awakened by thunder. I've kind of crept out of the tent and come down to the shore of Lake Lila. There's just a tapestry, this incredible depth and richness of bird sound.
Alan joins me on the beach, arms crossed against the morning chill.
It's really pretty. Reminds me a lot of Alaska.
Already there are dashes of fall color, amber and ochre on the hillsides. But as we break camp and load the canoes to head for home, a squall blows across Lake Lila, drumming up a last gorgeous smell of summer dust and pine needles. For NPR News, I'm Brian Mann in New York's Adirondack Mountains. This is NPR News.
This next story reminds us of an unusual case of heroism in World War II. It was heroism in the service of science. During the war, German troops surrounded the Russian city of Leningrad, as St. Petersburg was known. Hundreds of thousands died of disease and starvation during the siege. During this terrible time, a small group of Soviet scientists guarded a rare collection of potatoes and plant seeds. They feared that years of research would be lost. The scientists refused to consume their collection and were among those who starved to death. 70 years later, their research institute is again under threat, this time from real estate developers. Here's NPR's David Green.
The Vavilov Institute of Plant Industry is in the same building in downtown St. Petersburg where those scientists huddled during the war. But much of the institute's work takes place 45 minutes away in a garden that holds clues to different strands of fruit, how they can survive harsh climates, and which ones make people healthier.
Let's go. The curator of this collection, it's mine collection.
Leonid Burmistrov has been a scientist for the Institute for 40 years. Out here in the village of Pavlovsk, hundreds of varieties of fruit and berries stretch across acres. Burmistrov studies everything.
Like the winter resistant, resistant to different kinds of the fungi diseases or bacterial diseases and so on. What is the quality? What is the taste? And so on.
Until this fall, when the Russian government plans to sell much of this land to developers. The gardens aren't what they used to be, and weeds have taken over in spots. But Burmistrov says these plants remain vital to science. The idea of ripping them from the ground?
No, of course. No. It's not possible to think about that possibility.
Through history, this institute has had a love-hate relationship with Russia's rulers. In 1940, Joseph Stalin imprisoned the institute's namesake, Nikolai Vavilov, because Stalin didn't agree with his genetic research, and Vavilov died in prison. In the Cold War, though, the Kremlin was committed to science like this as a way to outshine the U.S. Today, the man leading Pavlovsk, Fyodor Mikhovich, still calls himself a simple Soviet director. He's written to everyone, up to President Dmitry Medvedev, to try to save this place. Sounding nostalgic, he says communist leaders would have supported him.
This feels like deliberate destruction, a continuation of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, when famous scientists were destroyed along with the science of genetics. Today, they want to bury the legacy of the genetics founded by the great scientist Nikolai Vavilov. What will we, the Russian nation, have to be proud of if we ourselves destroy this?
A court ruled that the law is clear. A government property agency can sell off agricultural lands like this. It's not clear how much land will be auctioned, but much of the fruit collection appears threatened. Scientists here say it would take years to relocate the plants, and developers are in no mood to wait. They're poised to build houses for St. Petersburg commuters. Andrei Anisimov is deputy director general of the government's Federal Fund for Housing Construction Assistance. He's been on TV making the case.
These plots are not being used. The buildings are neglected and going to ruin. That's why the commission has every reason to make this decision.
Scientists from around the world have rallied to Pavlovsk's defense. There's a campaign urging people to send Twitter notes to President Medvedev. And on August 13th, a surprise. Medvedev, or the manager of his account, tweeted that the appeals had been noted and that the president had ordered an 11th-hour inquiry. But so far, though, no final word from the Kremlin. Scientists say there are few places in the world like Pavlovsk, and many of the strands of fruit they've carefully developed might never be recovered. What's more, says Peter Raven, director at the Missouri Botanical Garden, there's the symbolism of a collection scientists died to preserve.
In doing so, they provided a real model of drawing a line in the sand for biodiversity that's inspired everyone.
Only not around St. Petersburg, where people are more fired up about stopping the energy giant Gazprom from building a massive skyscraper amid the city's historic palaces. Many brush off the Pavlovsk situation as something typical in modern Russia, a spat over property that will just end up making somebody very rich. There's also a perception that Pavlovsk was lost long ago. 78-year-old Antonina Krekstina lives nearby.
Look at these gardens. They're neglected. They used to have everything here, fruit and vegetables. Now there's nothing. Soon they'll probably have to sell potatoes just to pay their workers.
Some of the gardens could be auctioned off as early as September 23rd. All the while, Leonid Burmistrov, the veteran scientist, goes about his business, as he's done for 40 years. There's a new strain of blue honeysuckle he's working on.
If they say us, boys, develop this crop, we're ready. Let's go to the flowers.
David Green, NPR News, Moscow.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. President Obama and members of his administration are in New Orleans this weekend, marking the 5-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lisa Jackson is there and with us. It's nice to speak to you again.
You too, Leanne. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Being in New Orleans now, 5 years later, what do you see that still needs to be done there that the EPA can do?
There's lots of work here. There's a need to reinforce all the wonderful efforts around livability, green building, sustainability that are taking hold in everything from school construction to home construction. And, of course, there's, like any urban area, but certainly New Orleans is no stranger to the need to continually focus on brownfields, on contaminated land that would be and could be redeveloped, but for, you know, sort of the investment of some public money that starts the economic engine rolling.
I want to ask something about the BP oil spill in a moment. But first, I'd like to return to a conversation we had last October when you were hopeful that Congress would pass a climate change bill, and they didn't. Now, your agency is issuing new rules and regulations, doing some of the things you hoped Congress would do, limiting emissions from cars and trucks, requiring some companies to install new technologies to reduce pollution. But how do you respond to the critics who say the EPA is overstepping its authority?
You know, Leanne, in some ways, we haven't changed our posture. I mean, I still call for and believe that legislation is a more comprehensive, better, more efficient way to make, you know, low carbon emissions part of our economic fiber, part of our sort of fiber as a country as we grow. That hasn't changed. And the other thing that hasn't changed is my belief that I have a legal obligation and an obligation under the Clean Air Act to move forward with regulatory steps. Now, I've said all along that this isn't either or. You can't pick legislation or regulation entirely. You have to move in a way where those two, if you have them, are consistent. So what we'll continue to do is take regulatory steps, but they'll be modest, each and every one, because the economy, business needs time to understand the regulations that are coming at them. And so there won't be any huge shocks to the system.
Do you have any hope that the Congress will pass a climate change bill anytime soon?
As far as climate change, I think there's been a lot of work done over the past months to reestablish that man-made changes to the climate are happening. And as we move past sort of the climate gate era, and I think we are, my hope is that Congress will come back to think about that question once again.
The oil spill that has really devastated parts of Louisiana, other Gulf Coast states. What do you think is going to be the long-term effects of the spill on the environment down there?
There's sort of two impacts. There's the environmental impact just in terms of critters impacted, ecosystems destroyed, impact on wetland, impact on beaches, impact on the economy as a result, impact on culture and way of life. All that, I think, is going to take, it's going to be a bit more complex question than just, you know, acres and acres and acres of marsh that die. We're not seeing that impact. We're actually seeing, because the amount of oil that washed up was less than originally feared, we're seeing some indication that the real impacts may well be in the deeper marine environment. So that, and that's an environment that hasn't been studied enough, even pre-spill, and so the research that needs to go on is that much more critical in my mind.
Lisa Jackson is the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. She joined us from New Orleans, Louisiana. Thank you so much.
Thanks again for having me, Leanne.